statistics that talks about, for example, in the United States, it says 60% of people, they suffer from a mental problem or mental problems or diseases. And 1 in 10 will need a psychologist or a therapist either now or later in their life. And 1 from 18, he would spend some time in a mental hospital. And all these people go through this, you know, mental issues only because they try to satisfy their needs in terms of trying to accumulate wealth and having a better life for itself, not for their akhirah, not for them to help people. They have. They're just never content. They want to have more. And we sometimes, I would say, each one of us, if we dig deep in ourselves, we'll find out that sometimes there are things that we're never content with. Take the example, the basic example, phones, mobile phones. I have a mobile phone. It's more than sufficient. But why is it I'm always wanting to have the best, latest model that comes outside? It's because I'm not content. Because I see that if I have the latest iPhone or the latest Samsung, it means I'm complete. But sadly, in 6 months later, my perfection falls apart and the new iPhone or the new Samsung or the new phone becomes my new perfection. And then I just want to get it. I don't need it, right? So we each one of us, we can find tiny examples in ourselves where we're falling in the trap of not being content. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواه از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
یا سجاد.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country. And that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognise that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well. And we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner. Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, national insurance contributions and tuition fees. You name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But, Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. As the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers. France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts. Neoliberal economics as applied to public healthcare has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good health care.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians protested in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, meaning the Day of Setback. Nakba Day refers to the defeat of Arab armies in the 1967 war, which saw Israel's complete occupation of Palestine and Al-Quds, as well as the displacement and disposition of more Palestinians. In recent weeks, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. During a press conference, Palestinian resistance factions vowed to continue on their path of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The criminal Zionist enemy must understand that the Palestinian people will always protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian people will sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Quds. Aggression against Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds will only happen over the dead bodies of Palestinians.
Nakba Day came just 19 days after Nakba Day of 1948, which saw the forceful displacement and disposition of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
As we mark the 55th anniversary of the Zionist aggression of 1967, we assert that we will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine. There is no such thing as Zionist sovereignty over Al-Quds or over Palestine. Al-Quds, Al-Aqsa, and Palestine belong to the Palestinian people.
Decades on, Palestinians have been trying to liberate their occupied lands by all forms of resistance.
As they mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of their land. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In a new report aimed at highlighting hunger hotspots, the UN bodies warned that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert, facing catastrophic conditions. The report says, beside other causes, the ripple effects of the war in Ukraine, including rising prices, are adding to the difficulties of people to provide food.
Today, food prices are skyrocketing globally due to war in Ukraine and wheat and food exports crisis. Afghanistan, as an importing and dependent country, has received major impacts. Since we don't receive imported food or goods, we witness a quick rise in prices and food scarcity. Now the prices of food items are doubled and few people can afford them.
At the same time, Afghan middle-class families are sliding into poverty and hunger, as unemployment has been on the rise. Some also say that they are struggling to make ends meet.
Unemployment and poverty have severely increased. Not only me, but all of the people have slided into poverty. Joblessness has harmed us all. Last year I was a construction worker, but today I can't provide some loaves of bread for my family as I am unemployed. We are unable to make ends meet. The prices of food items have already soared.
Advocates in the country express concern about Afghanistan's worsening situation, saying the West, especially the U.S., share a major role in world poor people's suffering.
If we provide the percentage, the U.S. is 60-70% to blame for the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan, mainly due to their moves and mistakes. In addition, now the Ukraine war is affecting the Afghan economy, so who is prolonging the war in Ukraine? Again, the Western bloc, including the U.S. and the U.K. Prolonging the war might harm superpowers, but it definitely ruins the economy and lives of vulnerable people across the globe.
The UN Refugee Agency has also called for $3 billion in urgent aid to Afghanistan before winter to avert famine and death. Afghanistan is facing multiple humanitarian crises. Poverty and hunger, in particular, are taking their toll on millions of people in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pakistan has joined the rest of the Muslim world to condemn the Indian ruling party. Two senior officials of the Bharatiya Janata Party recently made derogatory remarks that disrespect the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Indian envoy in Islamabad was summoned by the Foreign Office to record a strong protest. In a statement, Pakistan says the remarks have not only deeply hurt the sentiments of the people of Pakistan, but billions of Muslims around the world.
People in Pakistan are outraged by the insulting remarks. They are demanding strong action against those Indian officials, as well as calling on the Muslim world to put up a united front against this religious bigotry.
After uproar in the Muslim world, the Indian ruling party suspended its two officials, but people feel that is not enough.
This is a test for the OIC. The OIC has issued a statement, but it is not enough. This OIC must take a stand and raise this issue with Mr. Modi.
We condemn this. Such sentiments against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, hurts the religious sentiments of Muslims.
Pakistan's leading religious clerics have also condemned the insulting remarks.
All religious schools of thoughts in Pakistan have unanimously condemned what happened in India. We will work together and evolve a joint strategy against this incident.
The controversy has strained India's relationship with the Muslim world. Experts believe Indian ties could further deteriorate with the Muslim world if its leadership does not extend a public apology. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Families of Palestinian prisoners and rights activists have held a sit-in protest inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of some 5,000 political prisoners held in Israeli jails. Their solidarity action comes as some 450 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for the military court hearings for more than 6 months. These detainees are held in Israeli jails without charge or trial for a long time. Their only recourse to call attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food for more than 3 months, and Raed Rayan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since more than 2 months ago.
We are talking about the Palestinian administrative detainees who are boycotting the Israeli military court since the beginning of this year to demanding to stop the administrative detention. And nowadays, two Palestinian detainees are ongoing on their hunger strike.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers, where rights groups say they are denied their basic human rights.
Palestinian prisoners are being held under inhumane conditions inside Israeli jails. Israel refuses to respect the international conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners. We will continue our solidarity and our resistance until all our prisoners are free.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
Medical negligence, which is targeting hundreds of Palestinian sick prisoners, this procedure, we always talk about it, and we demand the international community to interfere and to stop such policies. And also the invasions, the daily invasions to the sections and prisons of Palestinian detainees.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Rights groups are calling on the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The moment of truth for the embattled British Prime Minister at the end of a day rife with speculation about his political survival.
Good evening. I can report as returning officer that 359 ballots were cast, no spoiled ballots, that the vote in favour of having confidence in Boris Johnson as leader was 211 votes, and the vote against was 148 votes.
It's a result that means Boris Johnson is now a weakened leader and with an uncertain future, although he himself doesn't think so.
Well, I think this is a very good result for politics and for the country.
Just in, it's
just I do. Just in this sense, I think it's a convincing result, a decisive result. And what it means is that as a government, we can move on and focus on the stuff that I think really matters.
But it's exactly this stuff that matters to people that forced members of his own Conservative Party to call for a no-confidence vote. Lockdown law-breaking parties held at government buildings at the height of the pandemic, when families were banned from visiting even dying relatives.
This vote was inevitable. We all knew it was coming. It was just a matter of getting the Jubilee out of the way. Why? Because the Conservative Party is really nervous about losing the next election. Let's not pretend this is about high principle. Boris Johnson was elected as an electoral asset. Now he's an electoral liability, and he's going to stay that way as far as I can see.
The sticky Partygate scandal played a major role in Conservative MPs challenging Johnson's position, but it was not the only reason.
It's about the end of party time in so many different areas. His green agenda is nothing to do with Conservative policy and is, in my view, directly responsible for the cost of living crisis. He's apparently failed to deliver on the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is essential to a unionist party, a party that doesn't want to see the breakup of the United Kingdom. And then there are small gaffes, times when he just doesn't look like he's taking the job seriously.
things came to a boiling point over the weekend when the Prime Minister was booed at an event celebrating the Queen's 70-year rule. And prior to Monday's vote, allegations of intimidation and arm-twisting by number 10 trying to get Conservative MPs to change their minds, and the last-ditch effort by Boris Johnson himself writing to MPs begging for a second chance.
So Boris Johnson managed to survive this vote on his premiership, but by a number that will continue to be an open wound for the members of his Conservative Party, which is why some experts say he won't be able to hold on to power for much longer. Saeed Pour is up, London.
The U.S. and South Korea launched 8 surface-to-surface ballistic missiles off South Korea's east coast early Monday morning. These follow North Korea's test firing of 8 missiles a day earlier. During a Memorial Day ceremony, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol reiterated his firm policy against Pyongyang.
Our government will deal sternly with any provocations from North Korea. While deterring North Korea's nuclear and missile threats, we will pursue fundamental and practical security capabilities.
North Korea has conducted more than a dozen missile tests this year. Still, Pyongyang lags far behind Seoul in conventional arms and the overall arsenal at its disposal. The U.S. stations 28,500 troops equipped with various advanced weapons in South Korea. It's that imbalance that some analysts believe motivates North Korea to continue missile and nuclear arms development.
North Korea attaches great importance to the balance of military power, but in terms of non-nuclear weapons, it's impossible for North Korea to catch up with South Korea or the United States and Japan. So the cheapest way for North Korea to balance its military power against South Korea, the United States and Japan is through nuclear weapons and missiles.
North Korea's missile tests on Sunday followed U.S.-South Korea joint naval exercises off Okinawa, with the participation of a U.S. aircraft carrier and South Korean destroyers. South Korean intelligence and satellite imagery analysis now indicate North Korea may be ready for a nuclear test, its first since 2017. Even before his inauguration in May, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol had staked out a hardline position on North Korea, advocating for U.S. strategic nuclear assets, more missile defenses, and preemptive strike capabilities. The question is whether such policies will make South Korea and the region safer. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine war are entering a new stage, as Washington and its allies in Europe continue to send military equipment to Kiev. The U.S.'s new plan to send long-range missiles to Ukraine has sparked a stark warning from Russia.
If they supply Ukraine with long-range missiles, we will draw the appropriate conclusions and use our weapons, of which we have enough, to strike targets we haven't yet hit.
Putin said Moscow is destroying U.S. weapons sent to Ukraine by the dozen. He said Russia is easily coping and targeting the shipments. Putin said the sole aim of the West supplying arms to Ukraine was to prolong the conflict for as long as possible. His warning was echoed by the Russian foreign minister. Sergei Lavrov warned the supply of advanced missile systems to Ukraine raises the risk of a third country getting dragged into the conflict.
The things that the Kyiv regime unapologetically demands from its Western patrons, firstly, overstep all bounds of decency and diplomatic relations, and secondly, are a direct provocation aimed at drawing the West into combat.
On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden agreed to provide Ukraine with HIMARS multiple launch rocket systems as part of a $700 million weapons package.
The capabilities in this package include high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, and guided munitions with a range of up to 70 kilometers, 5 counter-artillery radars, 2 air surveillance radars, 1,000 additional javelins and 50 command launch units, 6,000 anti-armor weapons, 15,000 155-millimeter artillery rounds.
HIMARS is a mobile unit capable of simultaneously launching multiple precision-guided missiles up to 80 kilometers away. Since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Washington has approved 11 military assistance packages for Ukraine. The biggest was last month and worth $40 billion. European countries have also followed suit. Aside from that, the United States has provided intelligence that helped Ukrainians locate and strike Russian targets. But where does the line between supporting an ally and actively participating in the conflict lie? Many believe that gray zone is getting dangerously blurred. One wrong political move and the fighting in Ukraine could quickly become a war between Russia and NATO.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, climate change and rapid population growth are shrinking the Great Salt Lake, creating a bowl of toxic dust that could poison the air around Salt Lake City. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Falvell. The piece is titled, As the Great Salt Lake Dries Up, Utah faces an environmental nuclear bomb. If the Great Salt Lake in the United States, which has already shrunk by two-thirds, continues to dry up, here's what's in store. The lake's flies and brine shrimp would die off. Scientists warn it could start as soon as this summer, threatening the 10 million migratory birds that stop at the lake annually to feed on the tiny creatures. Ski conditions at the resorts above Salt Lake City, a vital source of revenue, would deteriorate. The lucrative extraction of magnesium and other minerals from the lake could stop. Most alarming, the air surrounding Salt Lake City, Utah, would occasionally turn poisonous. The lake bed contains high levels of arsenic, and as more of it becomes exposed, windstorms carry that arsenic into the lungs of nearby residents, who make up three-quarters of Utah's population. We have this potential environmental nuclear bomb that's going to go off if we don't take some pretty dramatic action, said Joel Ferry, a Republican state lawmaker and rancher who lives on the north side of the Great Salt Lake. As climate change continues to cause record-breaking drought, there are no easy solutions. Saving the Great Salt Lake would require letting more snow melt from the mountains flow to the lake, which means less water for residents and farmers. That would threaten the region's breakneck population growth and high-value agriculture, something that state leaders seem reluctant to do. Utah's dilemma raises a core question as the country heats up. How quickly are Americans willing to adapt to the effects of climate change, even if those effects become urgent, obvious, and potentially catastrophic? The stakes are alarmingly high, according to Timothy Hawks, a Republican lawmaker who wants more aggressive action. Otherwise, he said, the Great Salt Lake risks the same fate as California's Owens Lake, which went dry decades ago, producing the worst levels of dust pollution in the United States and helping to turn the nearby community into a veritable ghost town. It's not just fear-mongering, he said, of the lake vanishing. It can actually happen. Say you climbed into a car at the edge of the Pacific Ocean and started driving east, tracing a line across the middle of the United States. After crossing the Klamath and Cascade Mountains in Northern California, green and lush, you would reach the Great Basin Desert of Nevada and western Utah. In one of the driest parts of the United States, the landscape is a brown so pale it's almost grey. But keep going east. And just shy of Wyoming, you would find a modern oasis. A narrow strip of green, stretching some 100 miles from north to south, home to an uninterrupted metropolis beneath snow-capped mountains, sheltered under maple and pear trees. At the edge of that oasis, between the city and the desert, is the Great Salt Lake. Utahns called the metropolis the Wasatch Front, after the 12,000-foot Wasatch Range above it. Extending roughly from Provo in the south to Brigham City in the north, with Salt Lake City at its center, it's one of the fastest-growing urban areas in the United States, home to 2.5 million people, drawn by the natural beauty and relatively modest cost of living. That megacity is possible because of a minor hydrological miracle. Snow that falls in the mountains just east of Salt Lake City feeds three rivers, the Jordan, the Weber, and the Bear, which provide water for the cities and towns of the Wasatch Front, as well as the rich cropland nearby, before flowing into the Great Salt Lake. Until recently, that hydrological system existed in a delicate balance. In summer, evaporation would cause the lake to drop about 2 feet in level. In spring, as the snowpack melted, the rivers would replenish it. Now two changes are throwing that system out of balance. One is explosive population growth, diverting more water from those rivers before they reach the Great Salt Lake. The other shift is climate change, according to Robert Gillies, a professor at Utah State University and Utah State climatologist. Higher temperatures cause more snowpack to transform to water vapor, which then escapes into the atmosphere rather than turning to liquid and running into rivers. More heat also means greater demand for water for lawns and crops, further reducing the amount that reaches the Great Salt Lake. And a shrinking lake means less snow. As storms pass over the Great Salt Lake, they absorb some of the moisture, which then falls as snow in the mountains. A vanishing lake endangers that pattern. If you don't have water, Dr. Robert Gillies says, you don't have industry, you don't have agriculture, and you don't have life. Last summer, as the water level in the Great Salt Lake reached its lowest point on record, and it's likely to fall further even this year, the lake surface area, which covered about 3,300 square miles in the late 1980s, has since shrunk to less than 1,000 square miles, according to U.S. Geological Survey. The salt content in the part of the lake closest to Salt Lake City used to fluctuate between 9% and 12%, according to Bonnie Baxter, a biology professor at Westminster College. But as the water in the lake drops, its salt content has increased. If it reaches 17%, something that Dr. Baxter says will happen this summer, the algae in the water will struggle, threatening the brine shrimp that consume it. While the ecosystem hasn't collapsed yet, Dr. Baxter says, we're at the precipice, and it's terrifying. The long-term risks are even worse. One morning in March, Kevin Perry, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah, walked out onto land that used to be underwater. He picked at the earth, the color of dried mud, like a beach whose tide went out and never came back. The soil contains arsenic, antimony, copper, zirconium, and other dangerous heavy metals, much of it residue from mining activity in the region. Most of the exposed soil is still protected by a hard crust. But as wind erodes the crust over time, those contaminants become airborne. Clouds of dust also make it difficult for people to breathe, particularly those with asthma or other respiratory ailments. Dr. Perry pointed to shards of crust that had come apart, lying on the sand like broken china. This is a disaster, Dr. Perry said, and the consequences for the ecosystem are absolutely insanely bad. In theory, the fix is simple. Let more water from melting snowpack reach the Great Salt Lake by sending less water towards homes, businesses, and farms. But metropolitan Salt Lake City has barely enough water to support its current population, and it is expected to grow almost 50% by 2060. The worst-case scenario for the Great Salt Lake is neither hypothetical nor abstract. Rather, it's on display 600 miles southwest, in a narrow valley at the edge of California, where what used to be a lake is now a barely contained disaster. In the early 1900s, Los Angeles, growing fast and running out of water, bought land along either side of the Owens River, then built an aqueduct diverting the river's water 230 miles south to Los Angeles. The river had been the main source of water for what was once Owens Lake, which covered more than 100 square miles. The lake dried up, and then for much of the 20th century, it was the worst source of dust pollution in America, according to a 2020 study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. When windstorms hit the dried lake bed, they pick up PM10, particulate matter 10 micrometers or smaller, which can lodge in the lungs when inhaled and has been linked to worsened asthma, heart attacks and premature deaths. The amount of PM10 in the air around Owens Lake has been as much as 138 times higher than deemed safe by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Local officials successfully sued the city of Los Angeles, arguing it had violated the rights of nearby communities to clean air. A judge ordered Los Angeles to reduce the dust. That was 25 years ago. Since then, the city of Los Angeles has spent $2.5 billion trying to keep wind from blowing dust off the lake bed. The city has tried different strategies, covering the lake bed in gravel, spraying just enough water on the dust to hold it in place, constantly tilling the dry earth, creating low ridges to catch restive dust particles before they can become airborne. The result is a mix between an industrial site and a science experiment. On a recent morning, workers scurried across the vast area checking valves and sprinklers that continually get plugged with sand. Nearby, inside a complex that resembles a bunker, walls of screens monitor data to alert the operation's 70-person staff if something goes wrong. If the carefully calibrated flow of sprinklers is disrupted, for example, dust could quickly start to fly off again. Dust levels near the lake still sometimes exceed federal safety rules among Utah's coterie of nervous advocates for the Great Salt Lake. Owens Lake has become shorthand for the risk of failing to act quickly enough and the grave damage if the lake dries up, the contents of its bed spinning into the air. Of what used to be shore of what used to be Owens Lake is what's left of the town of Keeler. When the lake still existed, the town of Keeler was a boom town. Today it consists of an abandoned school, an abandoned train station, a long-closed general store, a post office that's open from 10 a.m. to noon, and about 50 remaining residents who value their space and have lots of it. Cheap land, said Jim Macy when asked why he moved to Keeler in 1980. He described that period before Los Angeles began trying to hold down the lake bed as the time of dust. He recalled watching entire houses vanish from sight when the wind blew in. We called it the Keeler Death Cloud, Mr. Macy said.
When we look at the works of late Rauzati, we see that most of the works that he has contributed to Shia Library are related to the field of codicology.
So Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rauzati is a friend of Ayatollah Marashi Najafi also. Mm-hmm. And he had many trips to different countries like Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and different, you know, cities. And he achieved the permission of ijtihad and also the permission of narration.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher. What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The program, The Teacher, is about the lives and the works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, jurists, philosophers, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rauzati, mainly known as Allama Rauzati, one of the bibliographers, scholars in the field of codicology and the study of manuscripts and hadith studies. So let's get to his early life, Shaykh Ziyaniya, with you, inshallah. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rauzati, introduce him for us.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rauzati was born in 1308. In solar calendar, in Isfahan. And he was from the generation and offsprings of late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baghir Khansari, the famous marja' of Shia school of thought. And, you know, because of that marja', I mean the Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baghir Khansari, rahmatullah alayh, this household is the household of ulama and scholars.
That's right.
So the father of Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rauzati also was a scholar himself and was a student of Asad Abul Hassan Isfahani, the great marja', Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Naini also. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rauzati lost his father at 8. He was nurtured under the supervision of his grandfather.
From the mother's side, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, that's right.
Maternal grandfather.
Maternal father, okay.
And he started his Islamic studies in Isfahan. and in Madrasa As-Sadr, that is a very famous school, Islamic seminary in Isfahan, an old one. And after studying as the preliminary studies, I mean, he moved to Qom because Qom was a famous city right. from the time of late Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri on. And Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rozati moved to Qom to get benefit from the teachers, great teachers in Qom. And in this city, I mean, in the city of Qom, he participated in the courses of Sheikh Murtaza Ha'iri and also the courses of the great Ayatollah Burujerdi, Rahmatullah Alayhim Ajma'in.
That's right.
And here also in this city, he got familiar with the great Marja, late Ayatollah Mar'ashi Najafi, the That's great right. codicologist and also manuscript collector. That yes. I think that most of the audiences are familiar yes. with the personality of late Ayatollah Mar'ashi Najafi. So Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rozati is a friend of Ayatollah Mar'ashi Najafi also. Mm-hmm. And he had many trips to different countries like Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and different, you know, mm-hmm. cities. And he achieved the permission of ijtihad and also the permission of narration, because these two are different. Permission of ijtihad is showing and, you know, certifying that this person, this figure is authorized to deduce the fatawa and the verdicts from right. ayat and rivayat. Mm-hmm. And the permission of ijaza or narration of hadith is okay. the permission by which it's showing that mm-hmm. this figure, this person is eligible to transmit a hadith to other people and to narrate a hadith to other people.
So these are the two important ijazas that we have.
Yes.
For this ijaza to narrate a hadith and ijaza to become a mujtahid, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Okay. And in the past, they used to get a letter or a recommendation, okay?
Yes, recommendation yes. letter that shows these two yes, types right. of certification.
Ijaza nama, that's right. Okay. Thank you much, Sheikh, for a nice elaboration on the early life of Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rozati. And I think the Hawza and the School of Isfahan has produced great scholars during the history because, you know, beside Qom, Mashhad, Najaf, and Karbala, Isfahan has also been famous for producing outstanding scholars. And the Takht-e-Fulat Cemetery in Isfahan mm. is a place to the graves and the tombs of really outstanding great Maraja, Ulama, and scholars. This shows that this city has also had role in nurturing outstanding students. Okay, the main interest of Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rozati, I mean research interest, Sheikh Mahtavi, let's talk a little bit about them.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we look at the works of late Rozati, we see that most of the works that he has contributed to Shia library are related to the field of codicology mm-hmm. or manuscripts that we have. So better to say that the most outstanding work that has been published by him or compiled by him is the edition that he did on the work of his ancestor, Rawdatul Jannat, yes. that is related to the historiography of the great scholars of Shia, no matter in which field of study they are expert, from philosophers, mystics, jurists, and usulis, those who are mm-hmm. expert in the field of usul, or the theory of the jurisprudence. If
this is an anthology, I think, isn't it? A collection of the names of the great outstanding scholars of the Shia ones during the history, isn't it?
Yes, okay. We have one of the best source in this regard is Al-Dhari'ah, mm-hmm. being written and authored by Agha Buzurg Tehrani.
That's right.
And this is good to know that late Rozati is considered as the students mm-hmm. of Sheikh Agha Buzurg Tehrani as well.
Okay.
And also Sayyid Mohsen Amin.
Mm-hmm.
These two also, they are interested in this field of study, and he got permission of ijtihad from Sheikh Agha Buzurg mm-hmm. Tehrani as well. Because authoring such works and conducting these huge books without getting the permission of the great ulama has no value in That's the right. eyes of the scholars.
Okay.
So in order to compile or do edition over such books and have your book and work
treated as a reliable one, mm-hmm. you have to seek the permission of the great scholar in this field of study.
That's right.
And he was the one who benefited from this opportunity as well, because he is considered as those who got the permission of ijtihad from Sheikh Agha Buzurgi Tehrani.
That's right.
So this work, Rawdatul Jannat, which was authored by his predecessors, mm-hmm. Sayyid Muhammad Baghir Khunsari.
Yes.
It was edited, because through the years mm-hmm. that he was reading this work, he felt that a strong addition is needed for this work.
That's
I
right.
mean, Rawdatul Jannat. So this is one of the outstanding work that...
So he wrote a sharh on that, isn't it?
And it is not...
A commentary or something?
Yes, it was a commentary mm-hmm. and... Sometimes you may say it was addition. Sometimes to have
Takmila,
some,
isn't it?
Yes, okay. Some input mm-hmm. and editing the information which are there. It is not only mere commentary or criticizing the things which are there. Yes,
that's right.
You may say it this way. Yeah.
Sheikh Ziyaniyaz, some people might say that what is the use at all to talk about the family tree of an alim? Because Sheikh Rawdati also was famous for writing down the family tree of some of the great outstanding scholars. For example, to whom to what imam of the infallible imams the trace or the family tree of this person dates back. What is the use? And explain a little bit about this field of study. It might be very much interesting, isn't it?
Okay, regarding this field of study, first of all, we should know that Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam themselves have talked about their genealogy and their, you know, roots of their generation. Mm-hmm. So it shows that this is important. And also in Ziyarat Jami' al-Kabira, it is quoted from Imam Hadi alayhi salatu wasalam that kuntum fil aslab al-shamikha wal arham al-mutahhara. So it's important to know that from which generation this figure has come. Mm-hmm. Because the attributions, the behaviors of the grandfathers and grandmothers have effects on the behavior of the, you know, children. Of course, it's not the absolute cause, but it has some, you know, effects on the behavior of the children. So that's why Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, they were insisting on this point that we are from a pure generation. Mm-hmm. So now, if someone is from this generation, I mean the generation of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, that is Sadat and are the children of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, so they should be distinguished from other people.
Okay.
Besides this, in fiqh, we have some rules, that these rules are specialized for the children of Sayyida Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha. For example, regarding khums, it's separated into different sections. First goes to Sadat, and the other one is going toward the share of Imam.
Yes.
So to, you know, give this share of Khums to Sadat, we should know who is this Sadat. Mm-hmm. So that's why these, you know, points are giving us the importance of genealogy. And beside this, mm-hmm. because people... If you are aware of the background of your family, and you know that my family is a family that was trying to promote the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, I feel this burden more on my shoulders to, you know, take more effective steps in this field and try to take this burden more, you know, further in order to have more promotes in the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. So all of these reasons are maybe mentioned for the importance of this, you know, field of study and field of knowledge.
So we can say that there are some experts who have the expertise of tracing back your genealogy, you know, family tree to the very original one, especially if you are a Sayyid one.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's a knowledge, you know, and, you know, it needs...
What is the name of this type of Ilm al-Ansab or something?
Yes, Ilm al-Ansab. Ilm al-Ansab, or some people, they call it also Ilm al-Rijal, but it's Ilm al-Ansab.
Ansab, Ilm al-Ansab.
Technically, they call it Ilm al-Ansab.
That's right. As Sheikh Mahtavi also said, the late Rawdati was famous for writing takmila, or a kind of completion or annexation, isn't it, to some of the great outstanding books of the Shia history. One of them is Tabaqat al-A'lam al-Shia, which is very much famous, and Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawdati wrote on that. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, anything missed about the late Rawdati?
Okay, regarding him, I think this is also good to know that he had collected a very precious manuscripts on Islamic works, that he had been keeping all those manuscripts and books in his library. So it was a very rich library in terms of the Islamic manuscripts.
Was it in Isfahan?
Yes, it was in Isfahan. Okay. And besides being such knowledgeable alim, we should not ignore this aspect of his life, that he was really popular among the people, ordinary people. He had, as we say in Farsi, he was actually taking over the affairs of a masjid in one of the old neighborhood in Isfahan. And people would easily go to him, sit with him, and he was trying to solve the problems of ordinary people. So this aspect, which is always associated with the great ulama of Shia, should not be ignored. So besides their position in terms of knowledge, in terms of akhlaq, in terms of irfan, they had such view and picture among ordinary people that people would go easily to them, sit with them, speak to them from whatsoever problem that they had in their life. And he is also considered as those ulama, and there are a lot of stories and memories that still those people in the neighborhood of Isfahan or here and there, they keep with them. That's nice memories and stories with this alim.
That's all right.
May Allah bless him.
May Allah bless you. So also taking part in many conferences, you know, regarding the study of manuscripts and codicologies in Iran and different countries, the trips that he had in order to collect them was really, really the source of benefit for so many scholars. It was Sha'ban 29, 1433, according to the lunar Hijri calendar, that this outstanding man passed away. His body was taken into Takht-e-Fulat Cemetery, and he was buried in a room in which Mirza Muhammad Baqir Khansari, the author of the precious book Rawzat al-Jannat, is buried. He was buried over there. May Allah bless his soul. I mean Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati's soul, and also Mirza Muhammad Baqir Khansari, the author of Rawzat al-Jannat. Thank you much, Sheikh Mahtavi.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya for your presence in the program. The teacher talking about the late Sayyid Muhammad Ali Rawzati, mainly known as Allama Rawzati, one of the most outstanding Shiite codicologists, bibliographers, and historiographers. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode introducing another Shiite dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.